Welcome to another installment of Voices of the Middle East. This is Gudarz Akhtadari, your host. As you probably following the news of the Middle East, the war on terror, the way it's been labeled by Bush administration and then now continues by Obama administration, now is expanding to Yemen in the Middle East. The problems in Yemen are, have many folds. One is that there is a uprising of Shiite militias in northern Yemen against the government, which Saudi Arabia and a Yemenese army are constantly bombarding these Shiite dissidents, or whatever you want to call them. They are not from the same, class of the Al-Qaeda, in a sense that Al-Qaeda are mostly Sunni Muslims and from Saudi Arabia root. And so these, what is now being told on news about this recent attempt to bomb a Northwest airliner on the way from Amsterdam to Detroit by a Nigerian young guy that he was trained in Yemen. It's another part of the Yemen where the Al-Qaeda has some stronghold. Regardless, U.S. Is now entering another field for the theater, and despite the objection of Yemeni government and most people in the Middle East, it appears that by all pretexts, U.S. is going to get involved in another war in the Middle East, and that's basically what Al-Qaeda has promised, to bring U.S. into every Muslim country in the world and fight with them at different locations. And that's not really a good news. The fact that on that airplane, this Nigerian person, Abdul Muttalib, was able to smuggle some explosives is really the matter of accuracy of inspections in different airports and different flights. As you know, the flights are coming from all over the world to Amsterdam, to Frankfurt, to London, and then they bark from there to U.S. And there's so many unknown and uncertainties that may help such lapses in security. The problem, I think, is really the root of all these issues and root of all these fights or whatever they want to term them, terror war or war on terror or the conflict of resolutions or anyways. Regardless of that, this is the news of the military operations in the Middle East. As I said, Saudi Arabia forces have bombarded the Shiites in Yemen, and the U.S. is now sending drones to bomb Sunnis in Yemen. It appears that Yemen is destabilizes more and more, and that is by itself not a good news for the Middle East, and especially for Saudi Arabia, which precisely doesn't have much of a line border with Yemen in the south. In the rest of the Middle East, in Pakistan, the fight between residual of Al-Qaeda or Taliban or Pashtuns in northern Pakistan continues. There's not a day that we cannot hear the news about a bomb or a drone bomb in northern Pakistan, in Waziristan, and in other areas in the region. And so the instability of Pakistani system, especially with having a nuclear bomb, is very threatening and very cautiously pessimistic. On the other hand, in Iran, the uprising that started back in June continues strongly and gets more momentum despite the government's crackdown on the dissent. In the past month, one of the leading religious ayatollahs of the dissent, Ayatollah Montazeri, passed away at age 87. And that caused a lot of trouble for the government because the followers of Ayatollah Montazeri were mostly in line with the Green Movement. They wanted to do their mourning for the Ayatollah and were prohibited to do that. And there were some clashes. And then on the Ashura, which is the a day of mourning for Shiite's third Imam, Imam Hussein, also caused a lot of clashes in Tehran. This time, the violence erupted between the demonstrators and the government. Shooting happened. Close to 9 people are reported dead in these conflicts in Tehran. And still, government of Mr. Ahmadinejad has not been able to either control the dissent or somehow control the situation in the country with regards to nuclear issues and negotiations with the West, and especially with the Obama administration. Iranian government has not been able to come out strongly because of the lack of support from the national scene. And it appears that Obama administration is also hesitant to get involved with Ahmadinejad's administration, considering the situation in Iran at the moment. So that's another limbo that Obama is now trying to get a hand over it, and day by day things are getting south in that regard. For the show today, we have two lectures, pre-recorded lectures that happened in Portland. The first one was in December, and this is by an Iranian women activist, Kiana Karimi, who joined the Iranian community. Portland Stands with Iran and American-Iranian Friendship Council from Southern California. She's an activist, a women rights activist from Southern California, and she spoke about a movement that is a fundamental part of this green movement in Iran, the women movement, and specifically what is called 1 million signature campaign against the discrimination of women. With that intro, let's listen to the first lecture that happened at Portland State University on December 13.
Thank you so much for having me today. I'm so thankful to Portland Stand with Iran and also American-Iranian Friendship Council for having me here and for all of you for coming and joining us in this event. So today I will be talking about the work of 1 Million Signatures campaign, and I try to kind of put it in the whole context of women's rights movement in Iran and the relation of it to the recent events after the election, and finally what can we do here as citizens to help the movement in Iran. But before, can I bring it down?
Yeah, well.
Okay, no, it's good now. It's good. Before jumping to my talk about the campaign, I really like to give a very brief picture of the status of women in Iran today. It's so easy to think of an Iranian woman as a victim. I want to tell you that it's not true. They are strong in many different aspects of their lives in Iran. And although we face discriminations, legal discriminations, it's also important to note that the cultural aspect of our country supports a lot of progress for women. It's so easy to stereotype an Iraqi woman, an Iranian woman, and an Afghan woman into one group and call it a Muslim woman from one of these Middle Eastern countries. But I think it would be so naive to have such a stereotype. What's very special about Iran is that there is a huge contrast between what the citizens are demanding as far as the legal system and the current legal system in place. So basically, Iran, the way I experienced it, is a country with very conservative, limited, traditional set of laws and modern citizen. And this causes a huge gap between the demands of the society and what's actually being practiced by lawmakers and those who actually practice those laws. So my first question would be, what happens in a society that has such a huge gap between its citizens and its practicing legal system? As for the status of women, you can see a lot of women as engineers, professors, doctors, and a lot of other successful women in business and society, in art, different spectrum. And what happens is that, for example, you see a university professor in law that has witnessed a car accident or witnessed some sort of crime. If this same person who knows a lot about laws goes to court, her testify about that crime worth half of a man, because according to lawmakers, women cannot think as good as men, so what they testify doesn't worth as much as a man. If an engineer woman who can work independently, who has a lot of independence as far as running her life, wants to marry, she needs the permission of her father, and then when she wants to divorce, she has to go through a lot of struggle. Even she doesn't have the approval of her husband, because again, according to this legal system, the woman is a property of a man. Another example is that if a woman is hit by a car in a car accident, the bail money that the family receives is actually half of a woman, because again, according to lawmakers, the value of a woman is half of a man. So you see this contrast here. These successful women who could go to have higher education, who can be great faces in many aspects, they have to deal with this legal system. The social issues that is derived with such conflict is countless. But then beside the social aspect of it, I want to say that personally, it's very humiliating to work and live in such legal system, because you think of yourself as a modern woman, worth and valuable as a human, as much as man, and then you have to deal with this legal system that puts you as a second-class citizen. This is the picture of the middle of Iran, particularly. There has been a lot of efforts in the recent years, particularly after the revolution, to kind of change this system. One of the most important and effective efforts after the revolution has been the campaign. 1 million signatures campaign is started in 2006 by Iranian women, for Iranian women, and it aimed to collect 1 million signatures to address the Iranian parliament to revise and reform the laws that discriminates against women. The way that they try to do it is that by every signature that they try to collect from citizens, they actually engage them in conversations about the women's issues, and they want them to pay more attention to it. So the reason that we're collecting signature is not just raising awareness to the parliament, they know what's going on in the country. We actually want to mobilize this dissatisfaction that exists in the society to some sort of action. Every signature is an action. Every signature is a conversation about women's movement. And what it has done is that kind of spreading the conversation about women's right issues, not just limited to scholars and feminists and academic figures, but also to citizens. It's now in the heart of families, on the tables of on their kitchen tables, to talk about how they can change the conditions of women in Iran. Although they have experienced this dissatisfaction for years, but changing it to action is something new. There are a few things that makes campaign very special in its work and very effective. One is the face-to-face education that I explained for you. The other one is that campaign doesn't have any hierarchy. So it's not somebody that's sitting over there as a leader deciding about others how to act and how to go collect signatures. It's pretty much a horizontal network of activists who have equal rights to vote, who when it's the time for decision making, they all have the same equal voices, whether they're a founder or the member that have joined the campaign yesterday, they're all treated equal. So the democracy that we're demanding, as far as gender equality, is the first place that we're practicing it is within the campaign. We are trying to create this space that everybody has the freedom to voice whatever they think of without any sense of shame, any sense of guilt, any sense of fear of what they think of. And I think it has been a great contribution to make campaign a diverse place for a lot of different ideas, because when there is a discussion, you might see on one side of the table a feminist secular, the other side is an Islamic feminist. We have like housewives, sisters, mothers, many different women in the society that has been so far kind of worked separate from each other to deal with their own issues. Now they're together to kind of find one solution for something that they have experienced in different times. As you all might know, the whole women's rights movement is nothing new in Iran. It's been going on for 100 years now. It first started in 1900 during the Constitutional Revolution. The reason I always want to say a background to the campaign and the current women's movement is that a lot of people think of it as an idea that has been arrived in Iran in recent years, which I think is not true. The social movement has a long history in Iran, and we have seen many records of them. The first activities was the underground political activities of many women during the Constitutional Revolution. They tried to kind of express their demands as far as gender equality since 100 years ago, and they achieved some sort of social freedom for others women to join them, and later on we can see them in form of different NGOs, different schools for girls, which was made by these NGOs, and then later on we saw this huge wave of, in 1920, 1930, this huge wave of periodicals, poetries, writing journals, articles, so things that for the first time women were not just introverted in their own houses or in their own limited network of friends. They were coming out and sharing their dissatisfaction, their feelings about being a woman in Iran. And since then, the movement has experienced lots of ups and downs. It hasn't been easy. It has always faced a lot of resistance from the society, from the traditional mentality, from the patriotic mentality. And it has always subjected to harsh behavior from security forces. The arrest of activists in Iran is nothing new, nor their torture, nor their persecutions. We've always practiced, we always witnessed this kind of behaviors, and it continues to go on today. I mean, the picture I'm giving right now might be a very good, hopeful picture, but the fact is that the number of activists who have been arrested since the start of the campaign are about 80, actually not 50, 30 people more. And then it's not just the arrest that kind of makes us concerned. There are a lot of other types of pressure that stops them from their work. Their phones are frequently being tapped. The websites are constantly filtered. They have to change their domain names all the time. They've been beaten, they've been kicked, they have been harassed. They are held in solitary confinement without explaining the charges that they're facing. They have been banned from traveling outside. They have been banned from interviewing with activists or journalists from other countries. So there has been a systematic pressure on activists in Iran to stop their work for gender equality. And again, I want to emphasize over and over that their work is not political in any way. They don't have any political agenda. They're not for or against any religion or any political party. What they're asking for solely is gender equality in the legal system. Despite this pressure, the movement is going on, as Ardeshir said, and it's very hopeful for us to see such a thing. It takes a lot of courage and a lot of bravery. What are the form of pressure that they have been smartly using is that they don't necessarily go after the activists who are showing the most amount of contribution. Even if you collect one signature, or even if you only present in one of these protests, you might be cut and be arrested and be charged with prison sentences for a few years. Aliya Ekrem Dost is one of these people. She only attended a silent, peaceful protest about a year ago. And then she was arrested at her home 6 months ago, and she was charged to 3 years in prison. Right now she's in prison. Another case is Ronak Safarzadeh. her only charge was collecting signatures. She hadn't done any interviews. She wasn't a figure, basically, in the whole picture. She was just collecting signatures for the campaign. She was arrested in Kurdistan, and she was sentenced to 6 years in prison. And right now she's in prison. And we have many other records, like I said, that I can go on and on with. And I think it's very smart, because when you think that it's only the leaders or the most well-known figures of a movement that are in threat, you are more comfortable doing some little contributions. When the pressure is on everybody, no matter how little you contribute, you are in the fear of being arrested, then it's so hard to really join. It's so hard to make a good, a strong, groundbreaking bill. But people have been continued their work. What I like to say about the women's movement as far as its relationship with the election, I think it's very important to look at what happened before the election. For the first time, we had this formation of a coalition of women who were trying to express their demands from the candidates, and they were trying to ask candidates very specifically to explain their plans for the next, if they become president, what would they do as far as women's issues. What they were demanding was the executions of CEDA in our country. As you might know, CEDA is an international convention. It's a convention of elimination of all discriminations against women. Most of the countries have applied CEDA to their laws. USA and Iran are two of those countries that haven't been done that. It's a shame that we live in America and we don't have that in place as well. And what the women's activist was actually trying to gain was asking for the candidates that if they come and become a president, they would put CEDA in place. So that was a very, I think, visual, strong demand from activists. And it comes from a coalition from women's in, journalists, publishers, activists, artists, women from different kind of backgrounds who came together and asked for such a thing. As a result, for the first time, we saw the wives of presidents who accompanied their husband in the protests, in the campaign rallies, and in the interviews. And for the first time, we saw the picture of who is the wife of a candidate and if they have a program in place in case their husband is chosen as a president. I think that was a great achievement of the women's movement in Iran, that we could, for the first time, hear the voice of the woman as part of the whole picture of the presidential candidacy in Iran. After the election, as the videos shows, women were at the forefront of protests, just like men. They were together shoulder by shoulder. In many cases, they were building the first lines of the protest, asking for change, and kind of protecting themselves, protecting men from arrest, from being beaten. It was such an honoring, brave picture. I mean, every time I watch one of those videos, I feel deeply honored about what I'm witnessing. And this struggle has been going on. I mean, although we don't see much of it in the media anymore, and people are not on the street on a daily basis, but they have been used every national celebration day, any event day that used to be protests coordinated by government. Now it's protests coordinated by people to kind of repeat their demands for democracy and freedom. And I don't think the movement has stopped in any way. I think it has started with some deep roots in the society, and it will continue until we reach our dream for real democracy and freedom. As far as what the citizen can do here, I think there are a lot of things that a citizen can do here. Mostly what we want is civil support of other countries. We don't need political support, we don't need financial support. As far as the campaign, what we love to see is that a work of a campaign member or an article from a campaign member is being reflected in newspaper, in blogs, in books. Anything that shows solidarity of citizens of other countries with Iranian, women or men, whether it's about women's movement or it's about the whole, the bigger picture, the Greens, right, the Greens movement. And I think it's very important to think about how we can make some changes and contribute to the situation in Iran, Middle East right now, because we are all more interconnected right now. The peace in one side of the world might seem so far from how it might affect our lives here, but I don't think it's the case anymore. We're so connected in many ways that having peace in every spot of the world really affects our life here as citizens who can live in security and in calmness and peacefulness and make sure that our allies in other countries have the same conditions. If you'd like to get more information about the campaign, you can go to our website, it's signforchange.info. There's another website, movementwatch.com, which is mostly about the arrest cases. You can also go to campaignforequality.info, which is about our work here in California, in Southern California. Mostly what we do here in California is pretty much like what the activists do in Iran, which is collecting signatures, but we also try to put it in some context as far as living as an immigrant, because it's not exactly like the life that people have in Iran. We try to engage them in a conversation about how immigrants can help Iran, how this cultural diversity that we have over here can help us teach back the values that we have learned here. And people in Iran not necessarily might not be exposed to it because they're limited to one culture. And here we can see cultural practices from many different countries. I think it's a richness that immigrants here in the U.S. can bring for people in Iran.
You were listening to a lecture by Kiana Karimi. She's a feminist activist from Southern California with the 1 million signature campaign, which is a women's rights movement as part of the Green Movement in Iran. Before we go to the second part of the show today, I would like to respond to a question that one of our listeners made a call for Jeff. Jeff, you're right. The Al-Shabaab Mu'minin in Yemen is a Shiite, section of Shiite Zaydis in Yemen, and they are not really in any ways affiliated with Al-Qaeda. They are fighting for their own, I guess, sovereignty in the northern Yemen. And they've been treated harshly by Yemeni government and also bombarded by Saudis that sees them as, both Yemen and Saudi Arabia see them as agents of Islamic Republic of Iran and a Shia force. So don't forget that there are two different factions in Yemen that are now fighting with Yemeni government. One is the Shiites, Al-Shabaab al-Mu'minin, a Shia Zaydi group, and then the other side are mostly actually immigrants from Somalia that have crossed the Red Sea and have migrated to Yemen, western part of the Yemen, and they are claimed by CIA and U.S. government that have some connection with the Al-Qaeda. The second part of the show is a lecture by Rhys Ehrlich, the investigative journalist who was in Iran during the elections, last election, and he was also a guest of Portland Stands with Iran, an American-Iranian Friendship Council on a forum this summer, and we are rebroadcasting that lecture today.
Thank you so much. It's a real honor tonight for me to be here, especially in this room. I look around the room. We have Bobby Seale and Kathleen Cleaver from the Black Panther Party. I also write about jazz in addition to politics, and so I'm glad to see Miles Davis is here. And behind us, of course, are the farm workers, including Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta here, the portrait of the woman here. And I was honored just a week ago to speak with her at a press conference in San Francisco where she spoke out opposing the repression in Iran and supporting the people's movement in Iran. So Dolores Huerta is alive and continuing the struggle. I arrived in Iran on this trip. This is my fourth trip, and I had become friends with Hedia Tehrani as a result of a previous trip. Now, those of you who know who are Iranian know immediately who I'm talking about. She's one of the most famous actresses in Iran. She's known as the Marilyn Monroe of Iran. And she insisted that I stay at her house or her apartment while I was there. And it was going through remodeling and various things. Well, make a long story short, I ended up sleeping in Hedia Tehrani's bed. Now, this becomes one of these good news, bad news Iranian stories, because the good news was I was sleeping in Hedia Tehrani's bed. The bad news is that she wasn't. And so when I tell this joke to my wife, I reverse it, and I say, and the good news, my dear, is that she wasn't in the bed. But I had a chance to, by staying in with not in a hotel, not surrounded by the other press corps, to get out of the bubble that sometimes American and foreign reporters get into in Iran. It's tough enough to report from there. They give you a 10-day visa. You have to hire a fixer, translator through the government agency. They write up reports about everybody that you interview, and the report goes back to the government. So you're not restrained. In the past, I was told that I couldn't interview certain people and that I was conducting improper, illegal interviews and various things. And so they try to constrain reporters. And that's just in the normal course of things. That's even before all the big demonstrations took place. But by staying at a private house, I had a chance to meet a lot more people. One night, Hedia decided to go out at 1 o'clock in the morning. There were these spontaneous campaign rallies that were going on. This is just a couple days before the June 12th election. And you may have heard about them. Thousands and thousands of people were out in the streets honking their horns. We went to Vanak Square. And Vanak Square is kind of one big central part of Tehran. And there's a freeway that you get to, and there's an off-ramp for 2 miles before the off-ramp that was just backed up completely like a parking lot. And that was all people honking and a lot of people wearing green shirts or scarves or hijabs or whatever to show their support for Mousavi. There were also some Ahmadinejad supporters, but overwhelmingly it was in favor of Mousavi. And one night there was a clash. There was actual fighting that broke out, including tear gas fired by the police because the Ahmadinejad people were going after the Mousavi supporters. And so even before the election took place, and before all the upheaval, there was already signs that the government and Ahmadinejad was preparing to crack down against the people that opposed him. But I didn't spend actually most of my time in North Tehran, which is the relatively affluent area of Tehran. I went down to South Tehran, the working class neighborhoods. I went to the bazaar, and I always spend time interviewing people at random. So there's no government fixer or agent who can determine who I talk to, because I literally stop people on the street in their dozens to find out, to get their opinions. And it was quite fascinating. I've done this on all my trips to Iran. In fact, when I go to Iraq or anywhere else, I do the same thing. In this case, it was very, very interesting. There was a lot of support for Mousavi among ordinary people. There was a myth that somehow Ahmadinejad had the support of the working class and Mousavi was only supported by the upper middle classes and the intellectuals and the wealthy. It's simply not true. There was a lot of just ordinary people stopped at random who supported Mousavi. And there was a lot of resentment against Ahmadinejad. Why? A lot on economic grounds. The previous speakers mentioned there's something like 15% unemployment, 25% inflation. The official figure from the Bank of Iran was 23%, and it's at least 25% because they lied on the figures, maybe higher than that. So it's true that Ahmadinejad gave subsidies to, he raised salaries for some of the civil servants. He gave, increased the amount of money. When you get married in Iran, you get a loan from the government, which you don't have to pay back. He raised that amount. He increased subsidies to farmers. But at the same time he did all that, 25% inflation eats that, takes that away with the other hand. And people are not stupid in Iran. They're very intelligent. People were very carefully considering who they were going to vote for. And there was a lot of anger and resentment against Ahmadinejad among ordinary people. And we saw that come out later in the big demonstrations. So when we went to bed on Friday night, which the elections were June 12th, Friday night, we all thought that there would either be an outright victory by Mousavi or there would be a runoff between the two. If, you know, the two top candidates don't win a majority, then you have to have a runoff. And so people were completely stunned when they woke up the next morning to find out that Ahmadinejad had won allegedly with 62% of the vote, and that it was so overwhelming, that there had been such a huge turnout of 85%. A lot of young people voted for the first time. It's inconceivable that all of those people were voting for Ahmadinejad in those kind of numbers. And so as the days wore on, there were various studies that were done of the election results. So there were, for example, the Karoubi, who was the third, the second reformist of the four candidates, if the vote count given to him, it meant he didn't even get the support of all his campaign workers. That's okay, that tells you something. In the case of, according to the official statistics, that Mousavi lost his home. He's from Tabriz, which is in the Azeri region of Iran. You know, Iran is made up of different ethnic minorities, including people of Azeri or Azerbaijan origin ethnically. And he had huge rallies in the weeks just prior to his to the election, and yet he lost his hometown. So all those people who came out to rally for him somehow didn't vote for him when it came time to the election. The day of the election, the opposition forces knew there was likely to be vote fraud, so they were prepared with their own vote counters in different precincts, in different voting places, who were then going to text message the results from their location back to a central office so you could have a parallel count. And that sort of thing has been very successful in other dictatorial and anti-democratic regimes around the world, where if you have a parallel vote count, you can immediately find out if there's vote fraud. Well, the government shut down all text messaging in the country on the day of the election. Can you imagine that? And there were all these extraordinary methods gone to that clearly pointed to vote fraud. And I think in the months ahead, we'll find out the details of it as somebody on the inside will come out eventually and explain exactly how they did it. Nobody's exactly sure, but there's no question that the results were fraudulent. It reflects a very deep split within the ruling elite in Iran. I won't go into detail because some of it's already been mentioned, but basically the Ahmadinejad rigging the vote represents a seizure of power contractor, and that's when you make your really big bucks. In Iran, you make your big bucks while you're in office because it's so corrupt that it's a source of massive income, and the Revolutionary Guard runs businesses like oil and gas, like the customs. When they opened up the Khomeini Airport in Tehran a few years ago, it was supposed to be run by the government. The Revolutionary Guard literally walked in on the day of the inauguration when the president was there and seized the airport and said, it's ours. And then they proceed to get all the normal revenues, for example, the airport taxes, right? You pay taxes every time you go through an airport anywhere. So they get not only get that, they get all the bribery for all the goodies that come in. And the one good upshot of that is that the selection of wine is much better now in Iran as a result of their smuggling. And the last time I went, you know, you got like one vin de pays from France and one red, one white. Now at least you get a little bit of variety. So throw in some Australian Shiraz, whatever. All right. What happened immediately, and there is this very deep split within the ruling elite in Iran, which has contributed to all of the upheaval that happened later. But fundamentally, what happened was, on the day of the Saturday, people were so angry, they were convinced there had been a coup d'etat, a self-coup, on the part of Ahmadinejad and his supporters. So people were angry, they went out into the streets, and ultimately in the millions, not only in Tehran, but all over the country, not only the well-to-do, but working class women in chadors and very conservative dress, clerics in their turbans, the people were out in their millions demonstrating peaceably. It was not controlled by Mousavi. It was not controlled by anybody. It was an angry, spontaneous, peaceful movement. And it grew over time. And as it grew, it went beyond the immediate demand. People came out against the vote fraud. But as it grew, people became to question the system, because particularly after Khamenei, the supreme leader, declared that all the demonstrations were banned, that they were all illegal, that the election had been fined, everything was hunky-dory, to come out and start continue demonstrating at that point was to really question the system. And the people came out and continued to demonstrate anyway. And what happened was there was a movement, a momentum in this movement that went beyond anything that anybody had planned or could have conceived of. I certainly don't know anybody prior to June 12th who predicted what happened. It was something that arose from 30 years of anger at the Iranian system. And when you go out into the streets and you talk to people, you see people who are believers in the Islamic system, who believe in the constitution, which is fundamentally an undemocratic constitution, but they want to see reforms within the system. So that would mean greater freedoms, so that the Basij and the Revolutionary Guards and the police can't come into your home and dictate to you whether you are properly dressed on the street, or all of those kinds of issues of personal freedoms, women's rights. There's been a series of demonstrations around women's rights, but still within the framework of the Islamic system. They want to see a liberalization, if you will, of this system. On the other hand, there's also a growing movement of people who say the Constitution is fundamentally flawed. It's the Islamic system is the problem. We should have something like what happened prior to 1953, when Iran actually had a democratic, a parliamentary system, of course, of which the United States proceeded to then go in and overthrow, because the democratically elected parliament and the prime minister of Mossadegh had nationalized British Petroleum, which was, of course, a big no-no for the United States, and the U.S. then overthrew the one democratic government that had existed in the history of Iran and proceeded to impose the Shah and his dictatorial system, and his Savak, and his police force, and the Shah's adventures abroad, sending his troops to various neighboring countries, etc., all of which then led to the 79 Revolution. So in a very direct way, U.S. policy led to the 79 Revolution and what we see in Iran today. A little detail that none of the existing U.S. presidents has ever bothered to go into in any detail. Gudar's mentioned, and I want to just kind of briefly address this question, that when these big demonstrations took place, there were some on the left, not a lot, actually a relatively small number of individuals, who thought that given the history of U.S. Domination and efforts to overthrow the Iranian government, this must be yet another effort to do so. And it's a kind of a variation of the enemy of my enemy must be my friend. So the Iranian government has its contradictions with the United States, so therefore it must be anti-imperialist, and Ahmadinejad must be a populist and anti-imperialist, various names depending on the individuals you go to. And therefore the movement in Iran to overthrow him must be negative, because he's fighting U.S. imperialism. And it's quite true that, particularly under Bush, George Bush of the recent vintage, he went and invested a lot of effort in trying to overthrow the government of Iran. And in my book, The Iran Agenda, I detail how he, for example, paid and trained and sent money to Pijak, an Iranian Kurdish group who was carrying out raids inside Iran. They were backing Jundullah, which is a group of among the Baluchi people in the southern eastern part of Iran near the Pakistani border, who were carrying out literally terrorist attacks, like blowing up civilians and blowing up buses and so on. That all of this was sponsored by the United States in an effort to destabilize Iran. And the theory was, this was the neocons who brought us the successes in Iraq and elsewhere in the world. These folks thought that you could overthrow the Iranian government by causing chaos at the extremes, which would weaken the central government and cause the Iranian people to rise up and install a pro-U.S. government. Boy, I'd like to know what these guys are taking. Anyway, so you have, there were definitely these efforts. They were not successful. because these folks are very isolated. Oh, did I mention the MEK? We're now seeing them back in the news. This is the group in Iran, the Mujahideen Khalq. They're just in the news the last couple of days because the Iraqis have been going into their camp in Iraq. The U.S. was backing them as well. Now, talk about a weirdo group. They had been Marxist Islamists in the period prior to the 79 revolution. They fought against the Shah. They ended up fighting against Khomeini. They went into exile. They were welcomed by Saddam Hussein, who used them to fight against Iran during the Iran-Iraq War, which completely alienated the Iranians, including anybody who might have had some sympathy for them at one time. And when Saddam Hussein was overthrown by the United States, they switched over to the United States. And suddenly, they're the biggest backers of the United States. They're still anti-Iran government, of course, but they're that chameleon-like, that they can go from being Marxist to being pro-Saddam Hussein to being pro-U.S., and without even blinking an eyelash about there's any contradictions involved there. So the U.S. is very happy to cooperate with those folks. And interestingly enough, the backing that they're getting is from these ultra-right wingers in Europe and in the United States, who see them as a big anti-communist, anti-Islamic force to be used judiciously or not against Iran. So, the U.S. has this long history of trying to overthrow the Iranian government. That, however, doesn't mean that what people are doing in Iran is furthering U.S. interests. And all you have to do is get out into the streets and actually talk to people. This is my biggest beef with these phony leftists who are talking about this. They've never actually been to Iran. They've never actually talked to the people involved in this. All you have to do, like I did, is go out and stop people at random. And, you know, the U.S. has its set of issues that it's mad at Iran about, all of which are phony, and none of which in Iran mean anything. So what are the big issues as far as the United States are concerned? Iran is about to develop a nuclear weapon, right? Iran is supporting Hezbollah and Hamas, Hezbollah in Lebanon, Hamas in Palestine. And it's supporting terrorism in Iraq. But if you go out and talk to ordinary people in Iran, those are non-issues. Mousavi, Ahmadinejad, the reformists, the hardliners, they're all in agreement that the U.S. is wrong on this. So it's not like the people demonstrating in the streets want to come to power and therefore then agree with everything the U.S. has been badgering Iran about. And in fact, the U.S. has its own agenda. The reason it raises these phony issues, or exaggerates them, depending on what the issue is because the U.S. wants to reassert its control and domination in Iran. And so you look for a reason, not that has anything to do with reality, but has to do with what can inflame people, what can get people really, really worried. Well, my God, Matt Mullahs with nukes, that sounds like a good one, right? So you just make it up. The U.S. has been predicting that Iran will have a nuclear weapon with a matter of years since the 1980s. And the timetable obviously has gotten off somewhat, but, you know, they're 1 to 3 years away from having a nuclear weapon, and they've been that way for 20 years. So does this have any, can you think of any recent example where the U.S. has used this kind of logic anywhere in the world? You know, I'm having a hard time. Iraq, weapons of mass destruction, terrorists carrying nuclear material into the U.S. to blow it up. Oh my God, that's a good reason for war. I'm really scared. Well, it's the same logic when it comes to Iran, and it makes just as much sense. Now, that's not to say Iran isn't meddling in people's affairs and doing wrong things and asserting its interests in the region to the detriment of the interests of other people there. That's true. But it's completely exaggerated and overblown by the United States in order to promote U.S. interests. Now, so that's the phony argument on the left. In my conversations with Iranian friends, particularly here in the U.S., and even to some extent in Iran, but much more so here, people are really angry at what the Ahmadinejad government is doing, and upset, and understandably so, and they want to see some kind of international sanctions against the Iranian government. And some people support various efforts to sanction, you know, crank up the sanctions against Iran. I have not heard anybody here advocate military attacks on Iran, but I think there might be some confusion. There's, for example, in the Senate, the U.S. Senate is now considering a bill that would provide lots of money, millions of dollars, $30 million, to supposedly help technologically overcome a blocking of satellite TV images and, you know, making access to the internet easier, etc., all aimed supposedly at helping the movement in Iran. The House of Representatives has a bill that's not been voted on yet that is calling for sanctions, cranked up sanctions for anybody who exports gasoline to Iran. As you may or may not know, Iran still relies a lot, it has a huge amount of oil, but it has to import gasoline. So the idea would be to put pressure on Iran by limiting the amount of gasoline that could be exported to it. But what it would do, it would hurt the ordinary people of Iran who rely on that. So these kind of things, so that's Washington's answer, which is, how do you support the people of Iran? You crank up the pressure to overthrow the government there and bring in pro-U.S. people. And it's important not to get caught in the trap. Do not believe that the United States ever, ever promotes human rights in Iran or anywhere else in the world. They don't. They use the rhetoric of promoting human rights.
Their institutions are doing a good job, right? That the Iranians are depending on Voice of America heavily, and they're doing a good job in that department. You cannot compare today with the past. This is a different time. That's what I'm here to make sure that we do not look at Iran like the past. Even like 40 days ago, Iran today is different than 40 days ago.
Okay, I'm going to deal with that. That's what we'll have the questions.
I'm an American myself. I know what you're talking about. Yeah. But today,
First of all, I think the Obama administration has taken a different approach than Bush would have, for sure. And that's a good sign. I think his public statements in terms of not interfering, not meddling, but condemning the repression in Iran, I support that. The problem is Obama doesn't run everything that's going on in the U.S. And you have the institutions like the CIA, the military, who have long-standing ties and developments, and they have their own agendas and their own interests. So I think, I speak now as an American, I'm not Iranian, I speak as an American, and I think it's important that we continue to fight to make sure the U.S. does not meddle in Iran and to let the people of Iran determine their own future without U.S. meddling. So what's happened is, I saw what happened in 1999, when there was a student rebellion against the system was brutally repressed and ultimately defeated in the sense that the demonstrations stopped. And the entire ruling elite in Iran, including the reformist President Khatami, did nothing to stop the repression that was going on. And ultimately that movement was crushed. Today, it's very different. Somehow, all of these demonstrations are continuing to happen. And that nothing, in the face of incredibly brutal repression, the people are still coming back out on the streets. 2 weeks ago, at the Friday prayers where Rafsanjani spoke, some 10,000 people came out. Now, for those of you who are not Iranian, let me offer an analogy here. The Friday prayers are the bastion of the ultra-right wing in Iran. It's the Basij and the Revolutionary Guards out of uniform and all of these fanatic right-wingers. The only thing close to it that we know of here would be like, take an evangelical church, one of these mega churches in Texas or somewhere, and every Sunday it's filled with people who hate abortion and they hate immigrants and they fighting the culture wars against the liberals and they're shaking and rise up out of their chairs with the faith of God that they've been cured. Think of those kind of right-wing evangelical churches, explicitly political. And then imagine that on one Sunday, the whole place is filled with Jesse Jackson supporters and Ralph Nader supporters and people from MoveOn.org, and they're all cheering death to the dictator. Okay, well, that's what happened 2 weeks ago at the Friday prayers. It's unprecedented. And, of course, it was brutally attacked. They couldn't attack them inside the covered area where the prayers take place, but as soon as people were outside, well, on their way in and then on their way out, they were brutally attacked by these forces of repression, but it was incredibly brave. People came and they wore their green armbands and they even brought green prayer mats. Yes, exactly, at the Friday prayers. So people ask me a lot, what is going to happen? What is going to happen in Iran now? And nobody knows the answer to it. It's uncharted territory because the divisions are very deep within the ruling elite, and that does make it different from 99. And the mass movement has been able to continue despite a very heavy repression. So I can't predict in the coming days whether the repression will work and the demonstrations will quiet down or whether they will continue. So far, it looks like they will continue, but I don't have a crystal ball. What I can tell you is that the situation is unprecedented in the last 30 years. It's the equivalent of what if, and we all know that Bush stole the elections in 2000, Can I get an amen on that one? All right. So, all right. So Bush stole the elections in 2000. They took it to the Supreme Court, got a quickie unconstitutional ruling, basically a political one that said, we conservatives want to stay in power, 5-4, stop the vote count, right? And at that point, Gore folded his tent and went back. Now imagine just for a moment, if Gore had said, I don't recognize the decision of the Supreme Court. It's illegal, it's political, it's unconstitutional. Take to the streets. Show your anger at the Bush administration. And people did. And people came out in the millions and marched all over the country. And in result, the Bush administration called out the FBI and the Army and the National Guard, and they were shooting people in the streets. That's what we're seeing in Iran today. It's equivalent, because people kept coming out in the streets. And you know, if you did that, the mass movement takes on a momentum of its own, outside of the control of Gore or anybody else. Because if the Supreme Court decision was illegal, well, what else in the system is illegal? I'm starting to think about the whole system here, and do we need fundamental change? Thank you. And so the momentum develops, the mass movement develops a momentum of its own, and you can't put the genie back in the bottle. And if somehow that had, this is kind of the fantasy I dream about late at night, right? But let's say Gore had actually been consistent in calling for those kind of protests, and somehow Bush had been defeated as a result. And Gore came to power. He would have been a very different Al Gore than the guy before the election, because the mass movement would have propelled him there, and it's beyond his control, you know, if the mass movement continues. And I think that's what we're seeing in Iran. So I cannot predict exactly what's going to happen. I don't know who's going to end up in power in the short run. All I can tell you is you can't put the genie back in the bottle, and the people of Iran are speaking. Thank you very much.